Hi, everybody. It's Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. We are thrilled to be speaking to our next guest, friend of the site, Tom Holkenborg. You may know his name. His moniker is Junkie XL. He's one of the biggest names in the industry. He puts the most resonance in your ears. And I think he has some of the best hats in the business. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Pleasure to be speaking with you again. How's things in your world?
Sunny and finally warm in Los Angeles.
Excellent. Well, you're looking good. Your career's just been booming ever since we last spoke for Run All Night, and you were just finishing up Mad Max Fury Road. So it is an absolute pleasure to chat with you again.
Likewise.
Well, great. I'd like to go to the very beginning. You know, we're going to be celebrating the Mondo release of Justice League, and that's going to be your third title with the Mondo label. So before we dive into all the fun stuff, let's just take a trip back in time. What were some of the first things that got you into music, the first things that hit your ear in a very impacting way, and what influenced you early on?
Well, as a kid, I grew up in a super musical family. Everybody was playing a few instruments. So, you know, I grew up as a kid of like 2-3 years old, banging on a piano, which was standing in the living room. So it all started very naturally. And I started playing piano I started drumming on the piano, so that drove my mom crazy. So by the time I was 7, she gave me a drum kit. It's instead of like banging on the piano. And then I started playing guitars when I was 11, 12, bass a few years later. And then since I was 15, I worked in a music store, and that's where I got in contact with synthesizers, drum computers. So it all started pretty early on.
You know, every time I see a picture of you or a video, you've just got an amazing wall of dials and knobs and analog equipment. What were some of the first things that you brought to your house and made your own and built on?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I sold absolutely everything last year.
No way.
Yeah, I started collecting since 1979, basically because I was working in that store and people were trading in these old classic synthesizers to buy new ones. And so in those days, you couldn't give like a memory MOOC away, you know, and now they're worth like $20,000-$25,000 if you get a really good operating one, or a Jupiter 8 for $30,000. But not back in the day. You couldn't give them away for free. You know,
that's people didn't want them.
And so I bought them so cheap, and I kept buying them. And I kept collecting them, and I kept them all. And last year, I decided to sell everything. It got too much of a burden on me, not only creatively, but also the fact that I thought that these instruments need to be used and not only sit there and collect dust. You know, they're wonderful machines. And eventually, when we sold everything through Reverb, I found out how much I really had. It was close to 1,650 items that I sold.
Wow, I can't imagine that. I'm not sure I've ever owned 1,650 anything, and you just had musical equipment. That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. So that's the problem right there.
Well, a lot of times, you know, you look towards people to emulate when you start your musical career, and I'm guessing that your mother was happier that you were banging on a drum kit rather than a Yamaha or a Steinway. What is it about the banging that you found so cathartic, and how did you build off of those sounds?
So for me, the banging, it really came down to rhythm. Like, I was always drawn to rhythm. And since I was a very early kid, I was gravitating towards music that was very rhythmical in nature. So whether it was African music, funk music, early disco music, and also jazz and reggae, ska, like everything that was really like rhythm driven. And so that's why drums was my first instrument. And then later I started playing all these other instruments, but the rhythm parts always stayed very important. And all the bands I played in afterwards were always very strong in rhythm nature. And eventually I started Junkie XL, my electronic music career that was also very much driven by rhythm. And rhythm stuck with me when I got into film scoring, and it became one of the most driving elements in my film score.
Oh, absolutely. I think in the 2013 score to Man of Steel, I think you were listed as the rhythmic technician, if I have that right.
Rhythm designer,
that's right. Additional music and rhythm design. Well, one thing, I watched a movie a number of years ago called The Visitor with Richard Jenkins, and part of the story is that some people from, I think, Morocco came to stay in his flat by some circumstances, and they were drumming. And so one of the things they taught him, and I never quite knew this, is that different regions, different cultures have different rhythms or things that are inherent to them. So maybe in America, it's, you know, four beats, but the way that they played the drums was three beats. And I thought that was very palate expanding, because I'm not a musician myself. Who did you go to learn these things, and how did you, how did you develop your sound and your theory?
I mean, I had a classical upbringing through my mom when it came to like music theory. And obviously that was all based on Western music, primarily Western classical music at first. And so everything that you learn as a kid is very much built on four or derivations of four, you know, or multiple versions of four. And it's not until I got a little older when and got more into jazz, when rhythms became more complicated, and then when I got into it, not necessarily into world music as like a musician myself, but just like listening to certain things, and then the world opened up to especially the South American rhythms and the African rhythms. And then later my mom actually took tabla lessons from an Indian player who was a master, and that's when I found out that in India you're not even allowed to touch a tabla unless you pass like 3 years of singing lessons, singing the rhythms, and the complexity of it is absolutely insane. And so through my teens, through my 20s and my 30s, I got into contact with more and more complex rhythmical figures and what you can do with them. And at the same time, my harmonic language kept expanding, my melodic language, and studying. I'm still studying a lot, actually, to make sure that your vocabulary doesn't get closed off, but you learn new words. In that fact, literally, I'm studying Portuguese right now as like language number five. And it really opens up again, like the world of new words, how they're being used, and the same thing counts for music. It's the brain is one of the most incredible things that we have, and for me, it's just it's a sponge, and it wants to be a sponge. It wants to take in new information like every day.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that I was curious about is the more you learn, the more you absorb, and you can adapt what you've learned. But is there anything that maybe not that you've forgotten, but now that you're learning more things that you liked growing up, you just sort of put to the side or you've outgrown, and any music that you just don't lean into anymore?
Not really, actually. It's like... Things, when it comes to enjoying music or studying music, things take turns. And it's like you're stuck on one thing for a while, and then you're in a conversation with somebody and that person mentions like an album or a piece of music, and it's like, oh, I almost forgot about that. And then, you know, you wanna play that again. For instance, at this point, I'm studying a lot Antonio Jobim, who is like one of the probably most talented arrangers in bossa nova music, Brazilian guy, and his arrangements are incredible. And so I just heard a piece of him like a couple of months ago, and I forgot about I didn't forget about him, but you know, as like first option memory, you know, it's like, oh yeah. And then you start listening to it, and then you get caught again by what you were caught by earlier on in life. And because I studied bossa nova music for 4 years when I was 16, and so now I'm just going through this whole phase again where I'm just playing like pretty much all his music, you know, streaming, and then the ones that I want to keep, definitely I buy them. I'm just like listening to what he's doing and solutions that he's finding. Not that I have any intention to do a bossa nova score anytime soon, but there's like things in there that are extremely worthwhile to know and to have as part of your toolkit, to use that in future film scores, even though I will never do a bossa nova score. But it's like there are elements in there that are great to learn.
Fair enough. And maybe on that point, again, if you learn something in your 30s or your 20s and now you're listening to it again, I'm guessing you have more of an appreciation because you maybe know what went into it, and hearing it through the lapse of time has probably given you a more a deeper understanding, I assume.
But it also takes things away because okay. when you're younger, and you don't quite understand why certain things work that the way that they work, that you can listen to something and being so impacted by the power of it, especially because you're not 100% sure how it was being done. Let's say if you were to have the knowledge of all classical music in history and you have it in your head, any piece of music that you listen to will potentially fall flat because you can say, oh yeah, but that's why. Okay, yeah, okay, I can see. You want to have something left that you're wondering how that was being done or why does it sound so good? So actually, as you gain more knowledge, one aspect of enjoying music is disappearing, where on the other side, utmost respect for some of these composers is growing.
Well, I think you can say that about most creative industries because, you know, I'm in architecture. I do, I'm a film score fan, a movie fan, but what I do for the site is a hobby. And so I guess more to that point, sure, you know, I grew up studying Frank Lloyd Wright and Frank Gehry and Louis Kahn. And then you still think it's great years later. But again, like you said, you understand kind of what went into it and just, you know, and a lot of these things, every creative industry, almost everything you put your hands on, it doesn't just fall out of the sky. It takes revisions and it's crafted and input and sleep tests and a number of things. So, you know, as a consumer, I enjoy talking to you, but as a professional, I enjoy talking to you about these deeper meanings and things that go into your work.
Well, then, you know, the saying as well, that when people ask me, when they hear a piece of music and they say, whoa, Tom, how long did it take you to create that? And I would say 2 days and 40 years.
Very true. Excellent. Well, let's talk about something that feels like it took a long time to get into. I would love to go in through all of your, all the records and albums in your catalog, but sort of the meat and potatoes of this is Justice League. Now, I imagine that there's whole lot of backstory, whole lot of dirty laundry. We don't want to hear any of that. We just want to talk about the Mondo release of your music. It's roughly 4 hours. So, you know, you've done TV before, which has a longer runtime than a film. I guess, how do you start with the idea, or what is your first couple steps when you know that you have a runtime of excess of 330?
Well, I do want to point one thing out, and that is that yes, I've done TV shows before where sometimes you need to deliver up to, let's say, 9 hours of music for one season, but you cannot compare that with a movie like Justice League that has 4 hours of music.
Okay. Because
the way that a TV show is structured, even if it's streaming nowadays, it's that it's closed off chapters. You can see them individually. It's very hard to pause a movie like 20 minutes in and continue the next day for 30 minutes and then pause and then continue the next day for another 40 minutes and pause. And it's you're missing the flow, and you're missing the overall arc in how things are being built up in a certain tension when there's a little release and then it continues. So a TV show, even though streaming, it's more of a concisive thing. But even when you watch binge watch 4 or 5 TV shows in a row, there's still like that very clear pause and start again, which a movie is just continuous. So it's definitely a more complex building of an arc, I find personally. So the way that to stay in the lingo of your profession is that if you want to build a really big house like Justice League, you're not going to start designing the bathroom, right? I mean, you're gonna make some rough drawings. You're gonna show them to the client. They're gonna sign off on it, and then you're gonna get more refined in your drawings, and then you're gonna work with an architect or a technical architect that will tell you whether the construction holds solid with the materials that you want. And then you're gonna start building the foundation first. And then eventually, when the structure is standing, you're gonna get more into detailing and detailing. And when the house is pretty much done, that's when you're gonna discuss the color of the curtains. You know, it's not the first thing that you're gonna discuss with your clients. So very similar to a film score like that. You're gonna talk about concept of the score. You're gonna talk about colors that you want to use. You're gonna talk about like a rough theme for the Justice League that lends itself to turn into every other theme if necessary, that is long enough to play throughout the movie without getting bored, because you have 4 hours to fill. So you could actually write a theme that when it's done, it completes like over a time period of, let's say, a minute and a half or 2 minutes, like a more complex melody that goes to different places. There are lots of movies that I've worked on in the past where there's not even time to play three notes of a theme before another explosion hits and the music is inaudible. So it's a different way of approaching things, and you can take more time to develop themes for all the individual characters. I mean, the introduction of Cyborg is close to 13 minutes. I mean, what a dream for a composer to write a 13-minute introduction to a theme for a character. And so when we were working in 2016 on the 2-hour version of this movie, there was barely any time to have individual themes for all the individual characters because, you know, it was going so quick, everything.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in your response. First of all, thank you for explaining what I do as a living, because I think my friends have a difficult time understanding, like, okay, you build a hotel or a spa or resort. Yeah. Okay, well, that seems simple enough. No, but thank you, Mr. Holkenborg, for explaining that. Second thing, talking about the characters, you know, you look at something like Star Wars, you know, there's not a Chewie theme. You know, I could see how you could maybe go down the rabbit hole of, if you chase themes for individual characters, you need to sort of pull back and view what are the important pillars, sort of the foundation of your architecture, so to speak. I love that you brought up Cyborg's theme, because I think that I've got about six or seven themes that I wanted to talk to you about. And one of them was his. It was the Cyborg becoming human, all too human. Yes, it is 13 music minutes. It's fantastic. And I love that you have the canvas to sort of stretch your acoustic tarp over it. How daunting is that? Because he's a pivotal character, and I feel that maybe if it doesn't land, do other themes outshine it? Do you get worried about making everybody seem even in this group?
Well, the cool thing is that the it's hard to talk about one theme without in relationship with the other ones. So let's start with Man of Steel and with Superman. Superman, if you will, is the most two-dimensional character of them all. You know, he's always good. He's always loyal. He always wants to do good. He's loyal to his girlfriend, Lois. He has this unconditional love for humans, even though he scratches behind his ears, like, what the hell are these motherfuckers up to? But he, if you will, he's the most two-dimensional. In other words, he doesn't change a lot in between Man of Steel and then going to Batman versus Superman and then this particular movie, Justice League. Even though he's a little out of place when he gets woken up, he doesn't quite know where he is, but then when he knows where he is, he's back to his normal self. So it's warranted for a continuation of the theme that Hans wrote in Man of Steel and that we worked on together in Batman vs. Superman. It made total sense that it bled over into this movie, Justice League, with a little twist. Wonder Woman, the two feature films that came out by Patty Jenkins were never supposed to come out before Zack's Justice League, right? Zack's Justice League was supposed to come out first, and then the first Wonder Woman and, you know, whatever comes after. And in Batman vs. Superman, Hans and I introduced the Wonder Woman theme as a short snippet towards three quarter of the movie. And Zack wanted to take that theme but make it more sword and sandal. And we were both on the same page that we never understood why her music needs to be more feminine or more softer. She's the craziest of them all, if you will, because she's actually the one driving swords in people's bodies. And the other ones have all kinds of trickery doing whatever they need to do, but she actually does it with a sword. And so, if anything, she deserves the more badass music. The twist that I gave on her theme, that it's definitely more aggressive in the action moments, but I infused it with a lot of world music elements because the tribe that she's from, I wanted to create a feeling that they were always here and they will always will be. And for me, that world music character, it feels like it's so old and ancient and it will never disappear, like proper music from Arabia, from India, from Persia, you know, that really feels like it's always been here and it will always be here. Such rich culture. The same with them. So that's why I used world music instruments around her theme. And the female vocal that I used, which is this awesome vocalist from Tehran, is like her inner emotion and the sensitive Diane, because she's a very sensitive, loving character, but lethal at the same time. That's where the aggression kicks in when there's action moments. Batman, at the end of Batman versus Superman, the chapter of Batman, the man in agony, the man with that is like melancholic about his past, the man about losing his parents, killed by the Joker. That chapter is closed at the beginning of Batman for Justice League. It's a new Batman. It's a new Bruce Wayne. He knows what to do now. He's going to put together the team and they're going to man up. And so it's a new day for him. So also new day for music. So that's why there's a new Batman music approach that feels like it's a continuation of Batman versus Superman, but it's not the same thematics. So that's why I wrote something different for him. Then there's Aquaman. Aquaman has a little bit of a short entrance because musically speaking, because two major moments around Aquaman are being taken care of by one, the traditional Icelandic song being sung by the female choir, and second, the license song, this song of Nick Cave when he goes back into the to the sea. So, but he has like a very heroic melody, big played on brass that comes back a few times throughout the movie, but in those settings, he's always part of the group. So it's less of like a full feature, but more like a shorter moment. And then we have two characters left. And that is Cyborg and Flash. Now, the introduction of Flash is also being taken care of by a licensed song. So I didn't have much for me to play there. But his two major moments, first is when Superman is revived, and the second one later on in the movie where he's turning back the clock. And those two moments needed to be very emotional in nature. And that's where I wrote something for him that is infused with the Justice League theme. But that needed to be very, very important. And funny enough, the Flash theme and the Cyborg theme became somewhat a DC fan favorite, especially the Flash theme was really like, in the response that I've seen, at least online on my social media, it's like a overall majority of the DC fans really loved that theme maybe the most out of the themes for the movie. And then finally the Cyborg scene, that needed to be again very emotional in nature, and it's almost like this cycle of notes that he can't free himself of, which is the shackles to free him of this troubled relationship with his father, and eventually he's able to do so. But throughout the movie, this is like a reoccurring thing, and that's why it's this cycle of notes that he can't seem to break. And lastly, there's Steppenwolf / Darkseid / Motherboxes. Again, this needed to invoke a feeling of these have always been here, and they will always be. And instead of using world music elements for this, because that is for Diane, a Wonder Woman, I used here a very typical style of writing of orchestral music that took place around the turn of the century, from 1800s into the 1900s. And it follows really very much some German and Russian composers from that era that used like certain ways of arranging and writing their music. It also invokes that feeling of old. But we also know that that time period will never disappear. Like in 200 years, people will still talk about Stravinsky, the Rite of Spring. And so that kind of concludes like all the themes for this movie and the inspiration of writing something new or sticking to something that somewhat was developed before.
Talking about Batman, I love the idea that you know, these people, whether it's a TV show or a movie, they actually progress, and the idea that they are a new person and you can treat things differently. I like that aspect of it. That's a very interesting approach. But also the fact that each of these characters, different enough in history, different enough in mythology, could live with a different soundscape. And it's quite amazing how they all mesh together auditorily as well as they do visually. So I think that's the reason why it's a success.
Again, stick with the lingo of architecture, is that you have the overall structure of the house that you want to design, and then you have the individual rooms within the house, but also from the outside of the house, you're looking at the individual rooms. And if one room looks like an English cottage and the other room looks like a Roman palace, and the other room looks like a colonial kitchen from Mississippi or something, and the other thing looks like an African clay house, and so you get it could be interesting concept, you know, to do that, but you would not say, oh, well, that is a really incredible design house as an overall design. And so when you work on a film score and you write the different themes for the different characters, you need to make sure that they work together. You need to make sure that you can do a handoff from one to another. Like you walk from the kitchen into the living room and it feels like, whoa. And when you walk from the living room into the kitchen, it's like, whoa, you know, just like the same philosophy is like everywhere. And so it's very important.
Yeah, and I'm also glad you said that too. One of the projects I'm working on now is a massive hotel. We're struggling with the idea of, do we go minimalist so that we take the themes and the palettes that we have and spread them through the reception, the bar, the restaurant, the market, or do, like you said, you have a different identity for each zone. And it's really up to the architect and the client to decide what they want to tell the story, so to speak. So nothing's wrong. It's just how well it works when you look at it from, say, 30,000 feet. I do want to call attention to something. You know, you have 13 minutes. You have one track I love the most is, I think my three favorite tracks are At the Speed of Force. The next one is No Dog, No Master. And then there's a very, very succinct track that's called, Earthling is the one that you developed the Man of Steel themes. But there's this one track that's just minute and 14 seconds. And it really shines in just the last 20 seconds. So do you enjoy maybe the short form of a theme? Or do you, like you said earlier, you like to really stretch a theme out? It's a dream for a composer.
Listen, if you work on a film score that is 4 hours long, the first response is, oh, this is great. This is what you want as a composer. And then the fear starts settling in pretty soon after that, because then you need to deliver, you know, over 4 hours. And so if you keep playing the theme like exactly the same over and over and over and over again, you clearly haven't done your job right. So you need to also write a theme that you can develop, that you can take somewhere. And some themes you just work perfectly in an hour and a half film because they're short and they're condensed and they're kind of like blocked off and perfect in its own little environment. But not every melody is suitable to turn into like a 4-hour symphony, if you will. That's also what makes those classic composers so genius, you know, that they were able to take something complex but really stretch it out over a symphony with the most incredible tools that they had at their disposal. And So that's important. And I think I love the idea of stretching something out. My dance tracks, electronic dance tracks in the 90s and the 2000s were also, I was really stretching the limits, like how long a dance track could be and how long you were able to keep the focus of the audience like where they're supposed to be. And I've always loved that, taking time to develop something and instead of doing it all in 2 minutes or a minute and a half.
Well, one of the things I love about your music is that it's unlike anything you've ever heard. And as we've discussed, it's because you've developed your palate, listening to music over the years and trying different modalities. But of the dizzying resume that you have, what score do you feel is the most Tom? Because I think a lot of times when you're given a movie or a director says, I want this, sometimes it's sort of someone dictating you to write something that you wouldn't normally do. But what, if anything, do you feel is maybe what you would have written had you had no limitations, or, you know, you would have come up on your own on a Sunday or something?
Well, music is like how a person is, you know. One day you're grumpy, the next day you're happy. the third day you're ecstatic because you won the lottery or you got the job that you always wanted. The fourth day you're in a hole so deep because you lost a dear family member or something. Music is the same way. There's not just one character piece of music that characterizes me, you know, per se. Because my music goes through the same, if you will, mood swings as any person. And it's not necessarily true that if you're happy that you're writing happy music, and if you're sad, you're writing sad music. It doesn't work like that. So there are different sides of me that are emphasized in certain movies. Sonic the Hedgehog, people would say that doesn't sound like Tom, but that is 100% Tom, you know? Mad Max is also 100% Tom. Justice League is also 100% Tom. And so I have many aspects inside me that I love to explore, some of them more than others. But what combines all these movie scores together is that there's certain elements in there that are in common between all these pieces. Like, for instance, when I was talking with George Miller one night, we went out to dinner, and I was in Sydney at the time when we were working on Mad Max. And then he said to me, a journalist asked him once, you did Mad Max, you did The Witches of Eastwick, and you did Babe, and you did Happy Feet. How is it possible that you're making all these different movies? And he says, I'm not, they're all the same. And so he starts explaining what the commonality is between all the movies. And he says, therefore, I keep making the same movie over and over again, but in a different setting. So that's somewhat the case with my music as well. It's the same music, but it's in a different setting and a different approach to things. But the core of it is always the same. It's always rhythmical in nature. I use certain types of harmonies that I expand on, and I use certain types of melodies that I'm also expanding on. And if I were to play the Justice League theme in a Sonic the Hedgehog setting, you would be like, oh, that's what you mean. And if I were to play the Furiosa theme of Mad Max, and I would play that in a Justice League setting, you would be like, oh, now I see what you mean. So I think that's the core of it.
Well, thank you for explaining that, because the reason I ask is I had a conversation with one of my writers about just that thing. I thought that, and fairly or unfairly, I just thought that because you're commissioned to do something, I wasn't quite sure that somebody's what they're working on, whether it's a masterpiece or just a little sketch, was really them, because they were commissioned to it. So no disrespect, but I wasn't sure of how that really, you know.
No, and it's also I think a misunderstanding that composers are not told what to do. Composers are asked to do something based on what they have made before, and based on what the director feels your talent is. And it's your choice to go along with it or not to go along with it. If you don't go along with it, there could be a chance that that director says, well, then I'm going to look for somebody else. I mean, if I were to come up with an accordion score only for Justice League, Zach would definitely scratch behind his ears and say, like, Tom, are you sure this is what you want? It's like, sure, 100 accordions. What could be better? You know? But most directors, what happens a lot is that when you work, when you start on a movie score, nobody's telling me, Tom, I want you to do this. People say, watch the movie, and I'm so curious to see what you come up with. And so that is the moment to make your mark. So if you try to do something, what the temp score does, I mean, forget about it. I usually don't care. There are actually directors that never give me a movie with a temp score. They just give me the movie. Mad Max had no temp score. When I worked with Peter Jackson on Mortal Engines, he just gave me the movie without temp score. He wanted to know what I came up with. So, and then the discussion starts. Oh, what do you think? What do I think? And then a film score is always like a compromise between what the director feels needs to be done and what a composer feels needs to be done. And you meet each other somewhere in the middle.
Well, I want you to know that architects also have temp tracks. Now that there's Pinterest, a client can say, well, I want this vanity from East India, and I want this this painting that looks like a Warhol flipped upside down. It's like,
yeah,
okay, that's not how I would approach it, but we'll start with that. So yeah. Very interesting. So Tom, what do you like to do for fun?
Oh, so many things. At this point, I'm building my own guitar effects. I used to be an electro engineer in my teens. I had enough education to design my own things and build them. So that's what I'm doing a lot currently. I am a massive espresso fan, and I have invested a good portion of money in a solid espresso machine 2 years ago. I'm a big cooking fan. I've been cooking since I was 14, 15, and I do 10-course tasting dinners for friends and family, you know, during the holidays, and various different holidays, and I spent 4 or 5 days cooking. It's very intense, but really great. And it's just like learning a new language, like I told you at the beginning of this interview. So there's a lot. There's actually, I'm a very upbeat person, but the only moment I feel frustrated is when I wake up in the morning and I have at least 25 things I would love to do that day, but I can only do 5, you know? And so I have to pick the ones that I'm gonna do that day. So whoever invents the 48-hour day gets the Nobel Prize for me.
Well, that just makes you human, Tom, because I think we all have the things that we wanna do. And last question for you. You're a man who wears many hats. You record, you're working on your guitar project, you cook. But how many physical hats do you have?
Well, I used to have a lot.
Okay.
I used to, in the 90s when I started Junkie XL, I used to wear like this newsboy cap, and it became really part of my look, you know, and it got so funny that by the time it was 2003-04, when people would just saw like a black and white cutout of my face, they would recognize me because of the newsboy hat. And so I wore that thing all the way up to 2012 or so. And I still do every now and then. I still have like 6 or 7 or so, but I used to have a lot, including baseball caps and everything.
Okay. Well, as we progress into the rest of the year, one of the projects that I hope you're excited about, because you've gotten to do Deadpool, you've gotten to do Sonic the Hedgehog, been in the Terminator franchise. I imagine that you still have wow moments, but are you how excited are you for the Roger Rabbit sequel that you might be co-composing with Michael Giacchino? Is that a thing you can talk about?
I don't know anything about that, honestly.
Oh, okay. I guess I'll go back to IMDb and poke around.
Oh, yeah, but IMDb, you can fill out whatever you want. You know? And it's not until the movie comes out that the film distributor will then fill out whatever IMDb is going to be. So everything you Google in the past is probably true, but everything you Google in the future is not. I'll give you a good example of that. So 3 years ago, somebody like yourself asked me, Tom, are you excited to do like the first Sonic the Hedgehog? It's like, what are you talking about? I don't know nothing about that. And it's said, well, it says on IMDb. It's like, well, some idiot just put it on there. And so I'm talking like 5 months before Sonic the Hedgehog, I talked to Tim Miller that I did Deadpool with. And Tim Miller is one of the producers on Sonic the Hedgehog. And so we talked about Terminator. And then Tim Miller said, yeah, you know, people say the most crazy stuff on IMDb that I'm doing this and that. And I said, yeah, Tim, I have the same thing. There's some idiot that put like Sonic the Hedgehog behind my name. And then Tim said, that was me. but it doesn't mean anything. Like I sometimes read on IMDb, like future projects, and just like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Okay, well, I will take the tail end of this interview and put it on as a PSA, not to believe anything on the internet until after it's been posted. Mr. Hulkenborg, it's been a pleasure catching up with you. Fantastic work on Justice League. Congratulations on this excellent Mondo release. 8 discs. Can you believe 8 XLP? From Junkie XL is amazing. Amazing work.
Thank you so much, man.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, and good luck with the site.